This hour we're talking about bullies, and you could make the case that the Soviet dictator Stalin was the ultimate bully. Stalin not only jailed and killed his enemies, he also terrorized Russians who weren't even involved in politics, like writers and artists. One of the most famous examples was the great Russian composer Dmitri Shostakovich. He spent much of his life worrying that the secret police would haul him off to the Gulag, or kill him. Shostakovich's life is now the subject of a new novel by the acclaimed English writer Julian Barnes. It's called The Noise of Time. Steve Paulson recently caught up with Barnes and asked him to read an excerpt from the book.
They always came for you in the middle of the night. And so, rather than be dragged from the apartment in his pajamas or forced to dress in front of some contemptuously impassive NKVD man, he would go to bed fully clothed, lying on top of the blankets, a small case already packed on the floor beside him. He barely slept and lay there imagining the worst things a man could imagine. One of his persistent waking nightmares was that the NKVD would seize Galia and pack her off, if she was lucky, to a special orphanage for children of enemies of the state, where she would be given a new name and a new character, where she would be turned into a model Soviet citizen, a little sunflower lifting her face towards the great sun that called itself Stalin.
Julian, your book opens in 1936, I think it is, when Shostakovich is terrified that he's going to be arrested and imprisoned. Why was he in such danger then?
Well, he was from the age of 19 when he wrote his first symphony, which was heard all over the world within a few months. He was the poster boy of music for the Russian Revolution. The trouble is, Stalin came along, and Stalin was interested in music and thought he knew what music was and should be, and composers were very closely watched. So what happened was that Stalin had heard about Shostakovich's very successful new opera, Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, and decided that he and three high members of the Politburo would go to a performance at the Bolshoi Theatre in Moscow. Shostakovich was hauled back from a concert tour he was on in northern Russia and attended this performance. And at the end of the third act, all of a sudden, the government box where Stalin was hidden behind a curtain, a small curtain, but where the other three members of the Politburo were well visible, all of a sudden, he noticed it was empty. They had not returned for the fourth act.
They didn't like
and
it.
So he set off, Shostakovich set off for Arkhangelsk to return to his concert tour. And a couple of mornings later, he went to the railway station to buy his copy of Pravda, opened it, and there on page 3 was a famous denunciation headed Muddle Instead of Music, which wasn't just, you know, your bad music review of the sort you get in your local paper. This was denunciation from on high. And that the final line of that editorial, it is a game of clever ingenuity that might end very badly. It still sends a chill through me, even at this distance of 8 years on. And that was the start of his troubles.
That ends very badly. I mean, that's almost a deliberate threat to the composer.
It is. And the next stage to that is to be called an enemy of the people.
So what didn't Stalin like about this opera?
Well, he didn't like the libretto. He didn't like the subject matter. He didn't like the sex. He didn't like the violence. And most of all, he didn't like the music.
So what did Stalin do to artists that he didn't like?
Well, if they were writers especially, they got shot or they got sent into exile. One of the advantages of being denounced on page 3 of Pravda, as the composers were, was that it didn't immediately mean you got sent to the labor camps in Siberia.
So there had been this devastating review in Pravda about this opera by Shostakovich. Why do you think he was spared?
It's an unanswerable question. Perhaps they recognized that Shostakovich was not only the greatest talent that they had, but also someone who was very capable of writing what they considered tuneful, graceful music. And Shostakovich didn't mind doing that. You know, he knew that Caesar had to be paid.
So what drew you to the story? I mean, why did you want to write a fictionalized version of Shostakovich's life?
Well, he's been with me for 50 or more years. When I was at school, when I was 16 or so, I read Russian, I studied Russian, and then I did it for 2 terms at university as well. And I'm a child of the Cold War, born in 1946. And Shostakovich's music, which I first heard when I was 18 or so, was part of my understanding Russianness and Sovietness. And then in about 1979-80, Shostakovich's memoirs, as told to Solomon Volkov, a controversial book, but one which many who knew Shostakovich has said is truthful, that was published. And I realized that Shostakovich was not just a great composer, but also a fascinating case. I can't think of any composer in the history of Western music who, on a daily, monthly, lifelong basis, was so much under pressure from power. And furthermore, as a writer in the relatively free West, it makes you ask the question, well, what would you have done in the circumstances?
Right. And what have you concluded in that? I mean, you must have thought about it. I mean, what if you were in that situation? If you were writing in the Soviet Union in the 1930s...
I would have been very careful, and I would have been probably what the West would have called cowardly.
Well, I have to ask you about a piece that you recently wrote in The Guardian, where, I mean, you talk about how Shostakovich was a coward, but it was impossible not to be a coward in his position. But you also say he's your hero.
Yes, I said my hero is a coward, or rather my hero is a man who considered himself a coward. He was a survivor and managed to write wonderful music.
So here Shostakovich was in the mid-30s. He'd just been denounced by Pravda. Clearly, Stalin did not approve of what he had done. I mean, you know, he was thinking he could be killed any minute. And then not long after that, he goes on to compose his Fifth Symphony, which is considered one of the masterpieces of 20th century music. It turned out to be a huge success at its premiere in Leningrad.
That's right. But the great controversy was about the final movement. It ends fortissimo and in the major after a great, thrilling, indeed hysterically thrilling, final movement. And I think Shostakovich knew what he was doing. He was giving them what seemed like a triumphant ending. On the other hand, it's kind of like a hysterical version of triumph. And it is. It's irony. It's Shostakovich's irony. He said of it himself, the last movement is like a man beating you over the head and shouting, rejoice, rejoice, rejoice. So it's a hollow and mocking version of a triumphant end to a piece of music.
But the Soviet authorities did not pick up on that.
No. I mean, that's one of the advantages of irony, that irony is something that a tyrant rarely recognizes.
Now, later on, I mean, after the Fifth Symphony, there's another episode, a truly awful one, where Shostakovich leads an official delegation to the U.S., and he's required to read a speech denouncing his artistic hero, Stravinsky. How did that play out?
He subsequently said, this was the worst moment of my life. I mean, he had a lot of bad moments in his life, but this was really bad. He revered Stravinsky. He said, without any shadow of a doubt, Stravinsky was the greatest composer of the 20th century. But he was sent in 1949 to the Peace Congress in New York, at which he was an official Soviet delegate. And then, to his horror, after giving his speech, he was then interrogated from the floor by Nicholas Nabokov, cousin of the novelist, who asked him a series of questions of, you know, what do you yourself think? Which was, of course, impossible for Shostakovich to answer. And it was a public shaming for him. And his life, as it went on, even though it became in some ways easier, it became materially easier, and after the death of Stalin, there was very little chance of him being taken away. His life, in a funny way, became darker because, you know, the most dangerous times are not necessarily the times when you're most in danger.
Yeah. He ended up living a long time. He died in 1975. He was very famous around the world.
Yes.
But do you consider this a tragic life?
I do, actually. I think it's a life of a man who was a brilliant composer, but who was kind of spiritually broken by the regime. He lost his soul eventually. I think this is how he would see it himself.
Now, this is a story, among other things, about legacy, about the legacy of this man, Shostakovich, and also about his art. And, I mean, artists die, but for a few, their art lives on for generations. And you have a passage at the very end of your book that gets at this, and I'm wondering if you could read that.
Yes, this is almost the exact conclusion of the novel. What he hoped for was that death would liberate his music, liberate it from his life. Time would pass, and though musicologists would continue their debates, his work would begin to stand for itself. History, as well as biography, would fade. Perhaps one day fascism and communism would merely be words in textbooks. And then, if it still had value, if there were still ears to hear, his music would be just music. That was all a composer could hope for. Whom does music belong to? He had asked that trembling student, and though the reply was written in capital letters on a banner behind her interrogator's head, the girl could not answer. Not being able to answer was the correct answer, because music, in the end, belonged to music. That was all you could say or wish for.
That's Julian Barnes reading from his novel The Noise of Time. He spoke with Steve Paulson.